propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Nyroff-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Pelle Nyroff-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. We've got two brilliant guests with us. They're all brilliant. Grant Smith, who's a former US military infantryman and author of The Radical American Mind on Substack. He'll tell us about the forced implementation of vaccines in the military, along with DEI. It's led to the exodus of a lot of good people whom the American military needs. And he'll also talk about other things like the extension of the Pfizer legislation. We've got, as our final guest, Scott McConnell, who's the founding editor of what, in my view, is actually the best American political magazine. And I'm not just saying that. American Conservative, whose views are sort of paleo-conservative, which means anti-interventionist, moderate of political judgment, and sort of family-oriented Christian values. And you can find it online. Much of it's free, but it comes out as a paper magazine, and it's head and shoulders above very high profile magazines like The Atlantic and The New Yorker and Time and the National, used to be the Weekly Standard. I think it's called the National Review, is another magazine, and they're all neocon and they're all crazy basically. But Scott McConnell's and his colleagues or friends there keep their heads tightly screwed on, as they say. But first, I'm going to talk a little bit about my previous interview with Lars Hedegaard. Sort of comes from another period, another era, because I guess a lot of people listening to this might not have been adults back in 2006 when we had the war of terror, as well as the war on terror. And what that means was that after 9/11, you had an explosion of anti-Muslim sentiment. And some of it's true. There was a lot of Islam is not a particularly liberal religion. And I wanted I had a friend who's a priest, a lot of priests around where I live, and he said he'd read the Quran and read the New Testament. And the word love never appears in the Quran, and all relationships in the Quran are hierarchical. So it's not equal. It's always about dominating or being dominated. And Allah is not benign like our God, as it were, but a sort of absolute force of total power and could be good and bad depending on circumstance. And there was a while when I read quite a lot about this and I didn't get a good impression. That said, I don't know, I've maybe come see things in shades of grey more now, reading the Old Testament and the Talmud, for instance. I mean, they're pretty vicious in parts as well. So I've withheld some of my judgment, but Lars Hedegaard was very much part of the debate of the period from 2001, 2015. And it was accompanied by a very large expansion of Muslim immigration into Scandinavia and a very huge growth of mosques and Sela mosques. And much of it was funded by Saudi Arabia. And there's a feeling that these small countries were being overwhelmed by forces that have been brought upon them by a totally out of touch liberal elite. And then you had, of course, the cartoon scandal, which Lars Hedegaard was very much prominent in being part of and writing about for an international audience. And this was the Danish right, particularly Danish thing. They have a very, very sort of scurrilous and sarcastic sense of humor, I'd say, in their political sphere. Their right to make fun of just about everything, and that included Islam. And that did not go down well in the Middle East. So there was a period when the Danes were fighting pretty much alone because the larger European countries generally didn't take sides with them. Anyway, we've now moved into a slightly different period when we've got the demonization of, or whatever you want to say, Israel. And I'm just reading here that there's complaints in Haaretz, as said, he's much more honest than the British and American press, talking about the wholesale boycott of Israeli artists and journalists and filmmakers from cultural events in the world. There's a quote here, but I get a phone call from the owner of one of the two venues where our festival was going to be held. He told me that one of his partners had a problem with the festival. He said that she was worried that after the festival, a young pro-Palestinian audience would stop coming to the movie theater. So this was an Israeli film festival to be held in LA which has a large Jewish population, but that was a no-no. And it's sort of similar to some of the boycotts taking place of Russian culture and Russian events after the invasion in 2022. So these things are happening. And of course, there's expected to be a lot of protests at the Eurovision Song Contest when an Israeli singer is going to be present. So this is from Haaretz. So if you want to get good Israeli news, Israel critical news, go to the Israeli English language press. We will carry on talking about the Middle East, I think, with Basil, who will have more up-to-date information on what's going on after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Niroth Telek Show on TNT News Talk.
The facts, no spin or agenda.
Not enough with the lies, we need the facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, Basil, political editor of TNT. What news have you got for us now that we can talk about?
I'm very disturbed. I've got to continue with the discovery of the mass graves. The International Red Cross has backed calls for an independent investigation. Bob Kitchen, Vice President of Emergencies, said the IRC was horrified at the news of the mass graves and echoed the call by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, for a thorough investigation. At the moment, it stands at more than 320 bodies and counting. But of course, at the moment, the Israelis are not allowing international investigators or even international journalists into Gaza. I just want to say as well, I don't know what the chat is saying. Perhaps people are saying, oh, well, Basil, why is he always banging on about this? But, you know, frankly, although the comparisons with the 1930s are often misplaced, nevertheless, I feel that at the moment, to be talking about anything other than this would be rather like talking about what's going on in the Amazon jungle in 1944 in preference to what was going on in the Second World War. And the fact that the legacy corporate media is ignoring so much of this stuff coming from, you know, very high level people talking about extremely serious events really only means that we should focus on it more, Pelle.
Yeah, and it's funny because Netanyahu said he compared the protests at Columbia and other American universities where people are sitting around and tenting overnight and protesting. He compared that to the German pogroms of the 1930s. I mean, he's never at a loss for a 1930s parallel, isn't that Netanyahu chap?
And Senator Tom Cotton as well referred to them as nascent pogroms. I mean, it's really idiotic.
Exactly. It's like a lack of perspective there, isn't it? Given what's going on in Israel compared to these rather tame, you know, sit-ins that haven't killed anyone so far, you know.
Exactly. And yet the legacy media, for example, headlines reading, protests at campus turn violent, when all the violence is coming from the police. And it includes, in several cases, elderly academics, including the wife of the Dean of Admissions at Emory University in Georgia, being body slammed to the ground, George Floyd style, with a knee on her neck, a 65-year-old academic. Really bizarro stuff. But of course, it all takes away from the important reportage on the hellish situation in Gaza. Also announced today, Reuters are reporting that Per Lodhammer, senior officer at the United Nations Mine Action Service, has told a briefing at the UN headquarters in Geneva today that the war has left an estimated 37 million tons of debris, and that it could take up to 14 years to remove the unexploded ordnance left by the devastating war. We know that typically there's a failure rate of at least 10% of land service ammunition that is being fired and fails to function, he said. We're talking about 14 years of work with hundreds of trucks. And what's more, the shelling hasn't stopped yet.
It's an incredible sort of parallel world that we're living in, because as I said, if you look at, I mean, to the Israelis' credit, you could say that there is a rather frank and honest discourse about Netanyahu's weaknesses. I mean, they don't shy away from saying how disliked Netanyahu is in America. I mean, they quote the news feeds from Haaretz is almost as critical of Israel as the news feed from Al Jazeera. So those are two good sources to go to, I think, if you want to find out. And, you know, the Israelis have that democracy.
Yet the news feeds in Britain and America are all kid glove, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's extraordinary, really. But what you mentioned earlier as well about the boycott of the Israeli Film Festival in Israel, of course, all across the United States, various laws have been passed requiring anybody to sign up an oath of allegiance to Israel and not to boycott it in order to win state contracts. I don't know if you're aware of
that. I'd heard of it, but good to remind us. Yeah.
Anti-BDS legislation. And the same applies in the UK. It's an absolutely abysmal law rushed through during the current genocide. They can't stop individuals deciding to have nothing to do with Israel. And, you know, the simple fact is that it's going to be a pariah forevermore. Mm. It's as simple as that. And these academic and cultural boycotts are only going to intensify in the years ahead.
Mm. Well, we're certainly at the pivot of history, I think. It feels like that, isn't it? Because the double standards are very apparent to the global South. We in the Golden Billion are sort of quite propagandized, and we have double standards about a lot of things.
I mean, even the term like double standards doesn't really go so far as to sort of highlight the egregious nature of the disconnect and of the unbalance, really. I mean, after the weekend when these graves were first discovered, Gideon Falter, of the so-called campaign against anti-Semitism, was prevented from intercepting and provoking the anti-genocide march with a police officer using the term "you're obviously openly Jewish" as one of the reasons why he was preventing him from crossing the road. This was blown up into some sort of national scandal, you know, with Falter claiming that he was being discriminated against because he was Jewish. He actually happened to have a Mossad thug with him on that trip. He was claiming he was just sort of innocently returning home from the synagogue and accidentally came across this terrible march of all these people waving Palestinian flags. I think it's pretty obvious what was going on. That story completely imploded, but not before he'd been interviewed on Sky News, called for the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police to resign, called for the officer who was dealing with him to be sacked, you know, claimed that this was an instance of institutional anti-Semitism or something. I don't know. I don't want to get sued for saying he said things he didn't say, but it took up all the oxygen in the room. Meanwhile, a mass grave of tortured hospital patients and children, some of whom are buried alive, isn't reported on. So, I mean, it just absolutely beggars belief. Before we go, I just want to do a quick pivot to another story, Pelly. The Ukrainian agriculture minister who was arrested on corruption charges. He apparently took part in an illegal acquisition of state-owned land worth $7 million. This is Mykola Solsky. He's denied the allegations but tendered his resignation yesterday. So, of course, I don't think the State Department has got any idea where this $60 billion that they're sending to Ukraine is actually going.
No, I mean, I saw on social media that this beautiful Rolls-Royce car parked outside a casino or something in Kiev, and apparently it's Eastern Europe, or maybe one of the world's only examples of this $600,000, whatever they call it, silver spirit or something. And that you can find that in Ukraine. So tells you that where some of the American money is going. But I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you've got a polarization because the Republicans are really wide awake to this sort of thing going on. And I totally agree with them on that. But Republicans, by and large, even the MAGA Republicans and anti-interventionists, are very supportive of Israel. And it's the Democrats, in my view, who have who have the right on their side. I mean, 75% of them disapprove of the Israeli administration, and only about 50% of Republicans do. Although a majority of Republicans under 30 are anti-Israel, and that's according to Haaretz. Anyway, Basil, hope you have a great weekend, and we will exploring the truth that you don't get in the legacy corrupt corporate media. This is the Pelle Nero Taylor Show. We're going to go off onto our third guest in this Friday afternoon. Thanks, Basil.
Thank you, Pelle.
Turn on Alexa and ask her to play
TNT.
Turning on anything else usually requires dinner and conversation, dressing up and brushing your teeth, and I'm already tired.
This is today's news talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nero Taylor Show. On this second hour of Friday afternoon, we've got Grant Smith, who's a former U.S. military infantryman and the author of The Radical American Mind on Substack. Look it up. He's going to tell us about various things going on in the veterans community, because I think he's got a high position there, and talk us, I think, through about the enforced implementation of vaccines in the military and the negative effects that has had. Welcome to the show, Grant.
Thank you very much for having me.
I just saw that you were, the word veterans always sends me to sort of, I don't know, gives me warm, fuzzy feelings, and you're Secretary of the Veterans Party or something.
Oh, no. So just to clarify, I'm still on active duty. So I'm currently a physical therapist. Right. So, you know, that said, anything I say is, you know, my opinions, not those of the U.S. Army or Department of Defense,
right,
or the United States Department.
You're going to tell us about vaccines. It's interesting to get away a little bit from the geopolitics of the world. But of course, the vaccines have been accused of causing untold number of deaths. And they were forced upon the military community. Did that have, what sort of effect did that have on the U.S. military?
So at the very least, we lost over 8,000 service members that were separated for not complying with the vaccine mandate. So I was on active duty at the time as well. I was not separated because I submitted a religious accommodation, which in the Army, they took a very long time denying those. So by the time they got around to denying my initial application, you know, I sent in an appeal, and that hadn't been denied when the 2023 National Defense Authorization Act rescinded the mandate. And so it's had a profound impact, not only in outright losing so many thousands of soldiers when we're in the middle of a recruiting retention crisis, it's also had an impact on all the people that were forced to undergo, essentially be involved in a medical experiment against their conscience, that didn't say submit a religious accommodation for whatever reason, and or try to get a medical exemption and were unable to, and ended up complying even though they didn't think it was the right thing to do. And then also all the leaders at Echelon that forced their service members under their command to do so, many of whom kind of felt that it was wrong, but have habituated prioritizing the institution over the Constitution, because this mandate was a clear violation of the constitutional rights of service members.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying it's been rescinded now?
Yes, it has been rescinded. That was a part of the 2023 National Defense Authorization Act. And getting that included in there was one of the key things that got Speaker McCarthy the speakership of the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. So was that basically saying, well, the vaccines didn't work? Was that an admission by the authorities that it didn't really wasn't really effective, especially with young people? I mean, most people in the military are young, you know, the whole thing.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No admission of such has occurred. In fact, you know, anybody that was an advocate for it. So, for example, our Secretary of Defense is the one who imposed the mandate, has not indicated in any way that it was a mistake or shouldn't have been done. And I think very much the narrative is that it was only ended via political means. And then now I think most people recognize that it was inappropriate. And I say most, I think north of 50%. It's hard to say exactly who thinks what, because the people that had the moral injury of, you know, doing something that was essentially wrong have every incentive to ignore it and try and move on.
Mm. Well, have there been any, I mean, do you know of any people in the military community fallen ill or had some, or even died as a result of these vaccines?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell us about it.
So, I mean, I can tell you about, you know, just one of the most recent anecdotes. Somebody reached out to me that was put in touch with me because I've been, you know, vocal critic of this policy, and was having heart issues that developed within 48 hours of receiving the vaccine. And now they are separating from service and very concerned. And, you know, that's just the most recent one, but there have been dozens of anecdotes that I know personally of issues, especially pertaining to things like stroke, pulmonary embolism, myocarditis, that, you know, were just unheard of in, you know, young and healthy populations. You know, we're talking, you know, 20 to 30 year old service members prior to the rollout of this mandate. You know, that said, I don't think that the rate of serious adverse events is significantly higher than, say, 1 in 1,000. So it's really easy to ignore if you have, you know, some motivated reasoning and that confirmation bias where you think that it was a good idea. And hey, all the medical folks in the establishment said that you should do this and it's what was recommended and it was policy. So for the folks that really believe that, I think it's the rate of serious adverse events is low enough that you could ignore it if you are motivated to do so.
Yeah. I mean, to play the devil's advocate, you could say that although if taking the vaccine saves more than 1 in 1,000 lives from not dying of COVID, then cruel as it may seem, those deaths are justified in the sort of, if it's unfortunate for those who die, but if somebody else gets to survive because of COVID, that's how all medical interventions work in a way. All vaccines work and that have some danger associated with them. But if they save lives on the aggregate, then they justify it somehow.
Exactly. But the thing is a risk-benefit analysis like that was never conducted. So the data hasn't been examined to do a risk-benefit analysis. I think if that was done, given the extremely low rates of morbidity and mortality in the young, healthy population that comprises the vast majority of the United States military, I think that we would see the absolute risk reduction associated with this treatment was substantially negative. But that hasn't been done. So until that gets done, and that would be great for that to be done. So that's talking about really two separate issues. It was illegal and unconstitutional the way the mandate was executed, but also it probably caused more harm than good. So those are two separate issues. You know, I think it's probably most important to focus on the unconstitutionality and unlawful nature of the order because that's more black and white. And we have sufficient information to know that with a high degree of certainty. And there needs to be accountability for that violation of law and constitution by people who swore to uphold and defend that same constitution.
I suddenly have this vision before me of, you know, in the 1940s and 50s, the Americans, I think, I mean, probably the Russians as well, but used to conduct nuclear explosions and have soldiers attend them. And there were people getting cancer decades later and so on. And I don't think they ever got any compensation for that. But anyway, We're going to go into the news and we'll get back. And I thought maybe we could talk about some of the other issues that you are concerned about and that you write in your Substack blog. Maybe Pfizer or something, and maybe where the U.S. administration is going right now and its sort of Orwellian tendencies. But we'll carry on talking about that with Grant Smith after a very quick news break. This is a Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on Friday afternoon, back after a break.
Deadline. TNT Radio News.
Big news.
Yeah!
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. On April 25th, former President Donald Trump faced a busy day marked by Supreme Court arguments regarding his claim to presidential immunity, as well as continued testimony in his New York criminal trial over alleged falsification of business records tied to hush money payments. The Federal Aviation Administration is currently investigating over 100 aviation incidents since the start of 2024, including crashes and near misses at major U.S. airports.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. On this Friday afternoon, we've got Grant Smith, who's a former U.S. military infantryman and author of The Radical American Mind on Substack, a commentator on American constitutional values, liberty and freedom in the USA. So, Grant, the attacks on liberty and freedom in the USA, well, they seem to be pretty ongoing at the moment. Could you care to pick us through some of the things that are going on for a kind of European audience? We might not be following U.S. politics that closely, but are interested.
I think there's actually a lot of similarities to what freedom-loving people in Europe are experiencing in the perspective, because I really think this is an international issue where there's a conflict between, kind of a emphasis on national identity and nationalism and, you know, a kind of internationalist mindset amongst a professional managerial class that, you know, the members of that class see themselves as more citizens of the world and don't particularly have as much of a loyalty to the country that they happen to reside in. And I think that we really see that with the latest decision to extend FISA for a couple of years in the United States, where, you know, this is clearly unconstitutional policy. And the Constitution is really all but dead in the minds of the people that really are the power brokers, not only in the United States. I think there's other similar values, but in the United States, it's very convenient to point to our Constitution that has a First Amendment. You know, it has a Fourth Amendment where we have a right to privacy and protection from unreasonable search and seizure.
I just intervene there. Sorry, because the First Amendment is the crown jewel, into my mind. In that's what a lot of people who don't like the American Empire, if you like, or hegemony, but we admire a lot about America. And one of those things is absolutely your First Amendment. But it's coming under challenge, isn't it? Because I think you tweeted about it or wrote about it. Because the NPR chief, she says the First Amendment gets in the way. That's incredible. But carry on what you were going to say. Yeah.
No, so it is absolutely horrifying. And then we have, you know, Supreme Court justices even in, you know, the Missouri v. Biden case, where it's very clear that our government is colluding with the tech industry. And I shouldn't say colluding, really, they were demanding the censorship of certain political ideologies specifically. And, you know, it's a clear violation of the Constitution. And there's a concern among this professional managerial class that, oh, well, you know, maybe if people have too much freedom of speech, that could cause security concerns. And there's always a trade-off, but that's the reason that we have that Constitution and that Bill of Rights with that First Amendment, to make it clear that as a nation, that is more important than any security concern. Because without that First Amendment, without those inalienable rights, America is lost. We don't have America. It's not really America. It's the same geographic area that's controlled by other people with other values.
Do you feel that as a soldier, that's what you're fighting for, in a sense, the American Constitution? That's what you, to, what it means to be American?
Mm-hmm. Yes, unquestionably. As a soldier, I swore to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, as did every other federal employee in the United States, for that matter. I think people like to play Orwellian games where they change the definitions of what things mean. You know, one of those common tactics is to talk about promoting democracy and not really meaning the popular will or what is popular with people, but institutions within the United States that are deemed, you know, quote unquote, democratic institutions, being able to execute whatever agenda they want to execute, regardless of popular opinion. So this kind of shell game and these language games allow people to, swear to uphold and defend the Constitution and these values while they hold values that are fundamentally opposed, and kind of believe that they're doing the right thing all along.
Mm. Do you, I don't know if you want, if you're able to be political, or how, because there's a lot of talk in my shows about how the American election of 2020 was stolen. And then, you know, a lot of people jailed for saying that it was stolen, the J6 prisoners. I mean, it sounds like a sort of really totalitarian thing, but these people are convicted for trivialities, really. And now it looks as if nothing has been done to avoid the potential for a stolen election in 2024, if you assume it was stolen last time. So is this going to be another kind of gigantic bust up? Will America last after 2024? And what role would the military have to play in this?
So I tell you, from the COVID vaccine mandate context, I think the majority of our senior folks in the military are more concerned with supporting and defending the institution than they are the Constitution. So when there's a conflict and there's a policy or something that needs to be implemented of dubious constitutional validity, if it's clear that that's what the institution demands and that's what's good for the institution, I think that leaders at Echelon can mostly be counted on to do what's good for the institution. And I think that that's a problem. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, we'll develop it. You've got two minutes to develop it.
So I would say that. And then with respect to talking about the election being stolen, you know, you had that Time magazine article where they talked about how the election was fortified. I mean, it's just a matter of semantics, really. Mm. You know, if your position is that the government shouldn't be using, academic and NGO cutouts in order to funnel taxpayer dollars into shaping people's opinions, suppressing certain political beliefs, using, you know, essentially money to support certain candidates over other candidates, intervene in the electoral process legislatively to say increase the turnout in mail-in balloting, reducing the amount of ballots that are rejected via lack of signature match. You know, you could say that those are, many of those are unconstitutional methods of intervening in an election or not. The way that they frame it is, there's absolutely concerns going forward, but there's people working on both sides to achieve, you know, the ends that they think are most satisfactory. Mm-hmm. And I think that as Americans, we should be focusing on doing things constitutionally the right way and
Are you, a lot of your colleagues in the military worried about the election of 2024, how it's going to pan out? You've got 30 seconds.
So I don't talk about it a lot specifically on that particular topic, but I have concerns that there are people in positions of power and influence that don't care at all about doing things in a constitutionally valid way, as long as there's no mechanism to hold them accountable. And on that note, militaryaccountability.net, we're trying to get accountability for, you know, the unconstitutional COVID vaccine mandates. And I think that's broadly applicable if we can achieve accountability there.
So militaryaccountability.net will carry on this dialogue that we're having. People who are interested in this topic, check out that website and also check out Grant Smith's Substack Radical American Mind. And think about the phrase that really captured me was, think about the military will be loyal to the institution and not the Constitution, sadly. So we're going to go into our next guest now. Thank you very much, Grant Smith. We'll love to have you on again. This is the Pelinero's Taylor Show on a Friday afternoon, back after the break.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, mate.
Here's a bushfire fact. Bushfires can occur without warning. So if you're traveling during bushfire season, here are three simple steps to remember. 1. Check the fire danger rating before you go. The higher the fire danger rating, the more dangerous the conditions. It may be safer to replan your trip. 2. Think about the area you're going to and what you would do if a fire started. How would you escape the area if you needed to? And where would you go? Check if there's a neighbourhood safer place. 3. It's dangerous to drive through smoke or fire. If you can't find a way to avoid the fire, park in a cleared area, face the car towards the fire, and turn the engine off. Then lie on the floor and cover yourself to protect yourself from radiant heat. Live bushfire ready. For more helpful tips, visit myfireplan.com.au today.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies. Because when people are fed, futures are nourished. Everyone deserves to live a full life. And with your help, together we can end hunger. Join the movement at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Discussing national and international issues, you're listening to Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show. We've got Scott McConnell on now. He's a founding editor of the American Conservative, which is sort of Tucker Carlson conservatism. Apparently, Tucker Carlson stole the ideas of American conservatism. It's a really great magazine, and you can find it online. And I think it aligns with a lot of the views presented on this show and on other TNT host shows. It opposes unchecked powers in government and business, promotes the concept of the nuclear family, free markets, and supports, above all, for us in Europe, very agreeable restraint and realism in foreign affairs based on America's national interest. It's also known as paleoconservatism. And we had Paul Gottfried on a few weeks ago, and he's said to be the founder of paleoconservatism. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Good to be here, Pella.
So you were critical. You've got one of your regular writers who I usually watch on YouTube, I mean, regularly, and then I read his articles in American Conservative, is Douglas McGregor. And he's got a worldwide audience now for his writings and talks about the failure of Ukraine to make headway against the Russian. Their inevitable defeat is inevitable, and that goes against the chauvinistic, pro-Ukrainian, unrealistic strain in a lot of American foreign policy reporting, although it's got better, and it's better than a lot of European reporting. What a lot of us in Europe are asking is, why did Trump was supposed to said, you know, he's gone to he's campaigning on a sort of I can end the Ukrainian war in one day, and a lot of people are hoping for him to do that. We have a kind of messianic hope that he's going to do something. But then he passes this. Well, he supports the passing of the $61 billion aid bill for Ukraine. You opposed that, I saw on your Twitter, but why did Trump do it and why did Mike Johnson do it? Have you got any thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts are that though I voted for Trump before and might well vote for him again, it's futile to rely on him on any point of political principle too much. And he has friends, political friends like Lindsey Graham, who are very hawkish. And as president, he appointed some people like John Bolton, who are also very hawkish. Mm-hmm. And I think he makes spur-of-the-moment decisions on what would be most politically advantageous to him, mm-hmm. like all politicians do, but Trump to like a high degree. Mm-hmm. And his reading of what his campaign required may be that Ukraine not collapse in the next year and have it blamed mm-hmm. on him and Republicans and his brand mm-hmm. of Republicanism. It's sort of kicking right. the can down the road. I don't know right. where that ends up.
Well, that's interesting. A lot of people who thought, well, Trump is, he's got really good instincts, and then are kind of surprised by his failure to hire the right people to push through his reforms of the swamp and his, he didn't start any wars during his first term, right. but, you know, he did all have, I mean, people said, why did he hire these guys? Is it to protect his political flank, or is he not the wise guy we all think he is? Or the man with the right instincts, even though he's a vulgarian and so on. But I mean, why did he get the...
The people in Trump land are now convinced, and they may be correct, that a second term would be better in that respect. He came into office, I think, not really believing he would win, and sort of surprised and sort of felt he had no choice except to rely on Republican establishment figures, and there will be less of that in a second term, I am told by people in Trump land, and they may be right.
Okay. American conservatives and your values, as it were, how common are those views in Washington? How, like Douglas McGregor, John Mearsheimer, I mean, they're kind of global YouTube superstars. How high a degree of awareness is there in Washington and among the American blob elite that Ukraine is losing, and how do they feel about that? Are they going to try and accept that, or are they going to try and escalate, do you feel?
I think it's dawning on them that it's losing, but they're not convinced. I think the awareness of the, say, Mearsheimer or McGregor perspective is, you know, maybe now about 25% of the blob elite, which is more than it was before. But I don't know where this ends. There's still a political majority in favor of, you know, everything for Ukraine in terms of the blob. And then you have, sort of military industrial interests at stake. And they always, you know, want taxpayer money to build and sell weapons. And it's, I think, the most powerful driver in American politics, and has been. Eisenhower called attention to it, more than 60 years ago.
I thought it was encouraging that Douglas McGregor, he's been retweeted by Donald Trump Jr. And Donald Trump Jr. Talks a lot to Tucker Carlson. And I think that Trump talks with admiration about Tucker Carlson. They've interviewed each other. So Trump must get this kind of input from various different sources. So he must know what's going on. I mean, he must know about the 500,000 casualty figure in Ukraine that McGregor touts at every possible moment.
Yeah. It's also hard. Trump is on trial now. And he, I think that takes up a lot of his time and energy. So it's, and he's, you know, not young. So it's, I think it's mistaken to assume that he's completely on top of all the nuances all the time. I mean, I think he shouldn't be on trial. It's ridiculous, but he is. So, I have some confidence that Trump would appoint some people from a McGregor perspective, but I wouldn't, you know, bet my house on it.
The American conservatives' other values, how common is that? Because using that as a benchmark, what I think is quite reasonable, you know, sort of Christian moderation. Is the much of the blob consonant with that, on board with that, or do they think, are you outliers in Washington?
You know, we're less outliers than we were 22 years ago, but it's always shifting. I was fairly confident until I'm a little shaken by the this Mike Johnson turnabout and the vote for Ukraine money, which also coincided with him getting rid of border protection as a necessary adjunct to any money for Ukraine vote. And it's almost, and there's this wide, as you probably see, widespread celebration of Johnson's, you know, acting like a grown-up and basically agreeing with what the blob says all across the mainstream media. And it's like, you know, happy Bush times are here again. And gosh, I don't think that's correct, but it may be. And we have to consider the fact that things which have been moving in the Republican Party in our direction for 6 or 7 or 8 years are, you know, are stalled and may even move back in the other way.
So you don't think it's a clever idea? I read somewhere, and all the enormous massive analysis and commentary I read, that Trump doesn't want to deal on the border because he wants it to get even worse and thereby win votes on that.
I think that's true. I think he does want to win votes on the border, but you know, nothing would happen on the border. I mean, the border would still be bad, and it's I'm a little alarmed that Republicans in the leadership of the House stopped talking about it. But I think for Trump, it is sort of like the worse the better a little bit as a candidate, yes.
Do you feel that I talk to a lot of MAGA people every day. I have four guests, the people are very good at saying what's wrong with America. I mean, unchecked immigration is going to change your demographics by the minute, sort of thing. And then I'm quite convinced that the election, there's a good case to be made that the election was stolen, and that the J6 prisoners are, I mean, it's a scandal that they're in jail, you know. But what are you going to do if it happens again? And there's no answers. So, you know, fool me once, it's shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. So millions and millions of people might find themselves in exactly the same situation as they were in January 2021, in January 2025. Right. What happens next, you know?
Yeah. I kind of think that a lot of unfair things happened to Trump in the run-up to the election, but I don't think it was actually stolen. I mean, there was a big sort of media cabal against him. There was, if you think the vaccines were popular, which they were at the time, there was an effort to keep him from getting any credit from it. Yeah, there is if they stole it from him then, when he had all the powers of incumbency and control of the Justice Department, why wouldn't it happen a second time? And there is no answer. They don't have answers to that. Trump is very appealing, but he has his drawbacks.
I mean, it occurred to me that maybe the people who say that the election was stolen without having prepared for the possibility of it happening again don't really believe it was stolen. Some part of their brain says, well, maybe it wasn't stolen after all. Maybe.
I think the line is that they would win it so decisively this time that there won't be a chance of fraud. But I don't understand. I've never dug down into the numbers. Like, do you have to win a state by 5% or you know, 8%? It's not clear. But so I think you're right that they don't really believe it's stolen, but it's it's become something that you say. It's probably not uncommon in human experience.
I saw somewhere that you're quite big fans of Hungary. There's a guy called Rod Dreher, who's a kind of hero for a lot of people in Europe. I think he lived in Hungary for a while. Do you sort of support that? Do you support the Hungarian
model? I do support that. I mean, I haven't gone the full Rod Dreher and lived there or met with Viktor Orban and his associates, but I think Orban is an admirable figure. That Hungary is doing well. I and my wife visited in 2019, and it seemed like, you know, Paris in the 50s. I mean, Hungarians were nice. The thing was clean. Obviously, Orban is, you know, not any sort of fascist or something. And he's Hungary, which, as you probably know, has, you know, a big museum devoted to the horrors of communism and the 1956 war, has said that, you know, Putin's Russia is no threat and it isn't. Doing the kind of fear mongering that all the other European governments, or most of them, are doing.
Yeah. I mean, he goes to these meetings in Brussels and he comes out. He's like our fly on the wall, you know, and he says they're all talking about transgender, war, and more immigration, which the European population is simply not behind these things. So
yeah,
there's a real detachment of the political elites from our publics. You know, I wonder why that's the case, because and we've seen a complete subversion of the language. So people like who have normal views, like I guess American conservative like Orban or myself, we're on the same ballpark. We're suddenly called far right, when in fact my views are more like European social democracy of the 1970s, yeah, which is you need national borders to create the kind of cohesion to pay taxes for a welfare state to take care of your elderly.
It's obviously true. What I don't know, which I'd be curious to know your opinion, is whether the trend in Europe is going that way and whether, for example, the right-wing populist parties, which are a mixed bag, but I'm sure a lot of them seem quite good, will like win a victory in June and that will transform European political culture.
That's what I'm sort of saying in my show, because I was based in Brussels and I've always, I keep sort of an interested eye in it. But there's three party blocks that are, you could call right or conservative. And according to Politico, the European version of Politico, they haven't made any headway at all. They're bumping along. Whereas the conservatives, the Christian Democrats, they've increased their popularity, whereas the socialist Labour SD bloc are about static. And that doesn't accord at all. I mean, everyone I know hates the EU and hates the usual stitch up between the blocks. Because the Christian Democrats is the part of Ursula von der Leyen, and she's very unpopular as well. This ice queen, this witch, with her very sort of intemperate remarks about war and so on. So she might get the job again. So there is a widespread feeling of real dislike for the European Union now. Not because of Brexit, totally entirely separate, people finding their own way. A lot of farmers protest and so on. And no one I know in Sweden has anything good to say about Europe at all. But it doesn't seem to be reflected in those polls. I don't know why. But of course, it's the only chance there is to create a European-wide opinion. But of course, there is no European demos. You know, we're 27-year different countries. And that's... Mm-hmm. That's the catastrophe. So we're all dependent on America because we can't unite. There is an argument. You all unite not to subordinate your identity, but to protect your identity. Like small guys have to unite to protect themselves against the big rapacious guys on either side of them, you know? And there's a logic for that. So the goalist logic of Europe. But we can't unite. So we're dependent on America still. And then we have to do what America says. I just don't know what the solution is.
No, I'm a little shocked by it. Like I'm so shocked by Macron's hawkishness and his British government's hawkishness. I mean, they're worse on Ukraine than the United States, which I would not have expected.
Well, I'm sort of thinking, I was researching and writing about Suez 56. And that's when America put its foot down. Eisenhower knew the Brits, of course. He wasn't naive about the Brits. But he put the Brits and the French in their place. And I think I'm bigging up the Americans on this show, because I think the Russians and the Americans have got to get together and have a back channel communication and put down the Brits and the French. Because I think these are real troublemakers. And I think the Brits are exploiting the fact that the Americans are going to be the backstop of their security. They're like responsible adults, and the British are really pushing. So they're sending their storm shadows into Ukraine. MI6 is all over the place in Kiev and controlling Zelensky, you know, and creating these fake scandals like they did in Syria over Bukhaz, probably, and sending Boris Johnson to stop the peace talks between the Russians and the Americans and trying to refight the Crimean War of 1856. You know, there are people like that in London, unfortunately.
Which the British lost, as I recall.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, but, you know, the American conservative, as I remember, I can't cite specific articles, understands all these things. And that's so gratifying to read that there are some people in Washington who get it, you know. But as I said, I don't read the Washington Post very much or all these papers, but it's too depressing. But if as you say, that is still the prevailing opinion, because I believe that change is going to come from America and maybe the MAGA movement. Anyway, thank you very much, Scott McConnell. We can find you on Twitter, and do read American Conservative. Did I say that? Love to have you on again. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on a Friday afternoon, and we'll see you on Monday with more brilliant guests and more brilliant news talk. Thank you very much, and see you on Monday.